Ms. Karen?
Your Honor, I have not signed in.
Okay.
Can I do so?
Yes, please.
And if you will sign in. Good morning, folks.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Ms. Perez, have you signed in?
I have, Judge.
Okay, thank you. All right, did you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
If I can reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. Good morning, judges. My name is Joan Burrows. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Richardson. We're asking this court to reverse the finding of the trial court and remand the case for new trial, given the trial court's failure to properly ascertain whether or not Mr. Richardson wanted to be tried by a jury.
Counsel, I think one of the things that the column brings up is the fact that your argument was not preserved.
Yes.
Do you want to speak to that? Because I think that's sort of the elephant in the room.
This is absolutely the elephant in the room, and as the court pointed out in the notice to counsel prior to argument about the Cave case as well as the, overarching jurisdictional issue. I think there are two ways to approach this, either through 5A18's ends of justice or through a jurisdictional argument. Certainly my preference and my embarrassment as counsel that I did not come up with this myself, but my preference and I think the easier way to get there is through a jurisdictional argument. Looking at the Cave case and the cases that came after it, those cases stand for the proposition that if there is no proper waiver on the record by the court, the defendant, as well as the Commonwealth, the court doesn't have jurisdiction to act as fact finder. I think that's exactly what happened here. I think we actually have a bit of the reverse of the Cave case in that case, as well as I think it was the Cartlett case or the Catlett case from 1956. In both of those cases, there's an improper recordation of the Commonwealth's waiver of a jury trial. In this case, we certainly have the defendant's lack of a waiver of jury trial, but we also have a record that doesn't, the transcript of the case does not indicate that there was a proper waiver by the Commonwealth either.
Well, the Commonwealth is actually indicating that his silence essentially would be tantamount to that agreement to be tried by the court rather than a jury. So would that impact your jurisdictional argument?
Does the Commonwealth's position at this point?
Well, they're indicating that there was basically the acquiescence by his silence to the colloquy, and that essentially would, I guess, for all intents and purposes, satisfy the requirements of Article 1, Section 8 in terms of the consent to being tried by the court. Would that impact the jurisdictional argument that you're now making?
I don't think that it does, simply because the case law is fairly clear that silence by itself is not enough to act as a waiver of a constitutional right. And certainly, we're not arguing that Mr. Richardson was the ideal defendant. He certainly was disruptive. He certainly brought his own baggage to the courtroom, as all defendants do. But my concern with the Commonwealth's argument and my concern with the Commonwealth's approach to this is that they're simply treating this as a decorum in the courtroom issue. My fear is that the argument would be that simply because he's being disruptive, and any defendants that would come after him who are disruptive are not due the same constitutional protections.
I'll ask Ms. Darren the same question, so I'll give her a heads up. If this was okay, could he have also said, I assume you'll, if you're silent, I'll assume your answer to the question that you're pleading guilty to the offense is yes. What would be the difference?
I don't think that there is a difference. And I think it's quite telling that the judge, when he goes through his colloquy with Mr. Richardson, assumes that he wants to be, be represented by counsel. He assumes later on that he does or does not want to testify, but then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, he assumes that he doesn't want to be tried by a jury. And I realize that the Commonwealth also suggests this causes a problem with how do we address it? How should the court address it? But I think...
Panel of jury.
Yes, exactly.
And what the Constitution requires.
Absolutely. And I believe it was the court, this court in Wright versus the Commonwealth, and then echoed in Robinson versus the Commonwealth. The presumption has to be jury. The circuit court is required to assume that all cases, unless there's a proper waiver, are set for jury.
I do have a more practical question.
Certainly.
You don't have to answer it. If he's already served all the time that he was given in the sentence, doesn't he expose himself to significantly more jail time if you win today?
I think that's certainly a risk that he could take.
And if he wants to take it?
I would respectfully... I think we get into the issue of client attorney-client privilege at this point. But that is certainly a risk that's taken, but I think in light of the constitutional issues and in light of the possibly very bad precedential value of this case, that's something that has to be taken into account.
Considering your jurisdictional argument, how are we to consider the order in terms of its validity? What would be your position in reference to that?
Well, and I think looking at the order on its face is invalid. It simply says that the defendant there refused to demand a jury trial. That's on its face improper because that's not the standard. The standard is he has to acquiesce to not be tried by a jury. There is no requirement that he demand a jury. He's owed a jury. It's on the defendant to it's on the court to ascertain whether the defendant wants to waive that right.
It's not just acquiescence. It has to be expressed or explicit.
Exactly. And so I think for those reasons, again, we can get there either way. The jurisdictional argument is obviously the easier way to get there.
Well, when we use the word jurisdiction, I think I think Judge Haley found probably the best quote I've ever seen. It said, jurisdiction is a word of many meanings, too many meanings. And we often use the word jurisdiction when we're talking about something other than subject matter jurisdiction. This is clearly not subject matter jurisdiction, is it?
No, it's not, Judge.
So it would be, as the Supreme Court said in Porter, the authority to move forward with the case, which Porter said is subject to waiver.
Certainly. And I think that this is certainly not a subject matter case. This is a case where it happened, the alleged offense happened in Nottoway County. It was a felony charge, so circuit court certainly has subject matter jurisdiction. But the problem is, without that proper waiver, did the court essentially have jurisdiction to act as fact finder? And
perhaps if the Supreme Court in some of those older habeas cases used the word jurisdiction, they really weren't talking about jurisdiction. They were talking about the court's authority to proceed. To hear and try the case.
Perhaps, Judge. And putting aside that if the court does not want to proceed under jurisdictional argument, I still think that we win under the 5A18 ends of justice exception. Certainly, there is no greater injustice than somebody being improperly deprived of a constitutional right.
There's not a lot of case law that would define a central right, though. I assume you would argue that the jury trial is.
Absolutely. I think it's mentioned specifically in the Constitution. This is not an issue of a case recently that I handled with indictment issues and things like that. This is something specifically laid out in the Constitution where the defendant is entitled to be tried by a jury. That right was essentially trampled over by a judge who was clearly irritated with the defendant, and that's simply, we have to ask the trial court to do better. We look to the trial court to have to be a step above these kinds of reactions, and I think that this was a very reactionary decision. And while I understand the court's frustration with Mr. Richardson at this point, especially given the record, I think we have to expect the court to do better. We cannot excuse this kind of behavior. And for those reasons, one other issue that I would like to point out, in the Commonwealth's case, there is an inference that the defendant is approbating and reprobating. And I think that's simply not true, that looking at the record and looking at the case law, the only person who is seeking to, the only one who invited error here is the trial court itself. The trial court hurried through the colloquy. The trial court attempted to handle the case in the way that it wanted to handle the case. So the only person inviting error in this case is the trial court.
Your client never asked the trial court to proceed in the manner in which it did, correct?
Correct. He sat there and was silent. So for those reasons, judges, I would ask the court to consider reversing Mr. Richardson's case and remanding it for a new trial, given the deficiencies.
Would that be a jury trial?
To be determined, Judge.
I'm guessing.
I think it's going to be difficult to get a waiver at this point.
Yeah,
from the
I would say you're right.
So, thank you.
Thank you. Hold on for one second, Ms. Darren. I need to get your time correct. It looks like it's reading at 11 minutes in.
Oh, I see. Yeah,
hang on for one second. Let's give you all the time you're entitled to.
There you go.
There we go. All right, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Lee and Darren for the Commonwealth. I'm going to go first to the Court's question about whether or not Article 1, Section 8 was a matter of jurisdiction, and when the defendant failed to verbally state a waiver on the record, whether that jurisdictional issue controls or whether 5A18 controls. We have argued that 5A18 controls. I'll bring the court's attention to some language in a couple of the cases where while this, in those particular cases, the convictions were reversed and remanded for new trial, the court nevertheless, in Boaz 165 Virginia 786, talks about that the manner of consent is not dictated by Article 1, Section 8. It says that the defendant has to consent, but the manner of consent is not dictated.
But how is that? We said it has to be expressed.
It certainly, let's look at what it says. And
we said that it has to be expressed.
Well, I'm looking respectfully at what the Article 1, Section 8 requires, and what Article 1, Section 8 requires is that if the accused pleads not guilty with consent and concurrence of the Commonwealth's attorney and the court entered of record, he may be tried, he may waive a jury trial.
But how does that impact right in reference to requiring, I think this is a follow-up on what Judge Russell was saying, the verbalization that silence is not enough? Doesn't that undercut your argument?
And under normal circumstances, and I think we can all agree, under normal circumstances, that is what should happen in a case. But this case presents a different issue. This case presents a situation of what is a court to do when the defendant's disruptive behavior precludes the court from getting that verbal consent.
Why wasn't a jury there in the first place? Because the defendant had never waived a jury on as of the day of trial. I mean, the court here looks to me just presumed that it was going to be a bench trial.
The record is silent on that point.
Well, it's not silent as to whether a jury was there, is it?
I don't know that it says one way or the other. It appears you could infer that a jury wasn't there, and that would make sense that the court proceeded in the manner that it did.
Well, Ms. Darren, the question that I said I was going to ask both of you.
Yes.
If you could use this technique to eliminate the default rule of jury, why couldn't you use this technique to eliminate the default rule of not guilty?
Well,
both are constitutional rights.
First of all, Your Honor, I'm thankful that we do not have that situation in this case. But second of all, if you look at the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Illinois versus Allen, and you look at this court's decision in Martin in 11 Virginia App, it's a 1990 case of this court, those cases are the cases that discuss the tension that we have between what is required, what are fundamental rights, and what is required for a defendant to waive those fundamental rights, and what's a court to do if the defendant's own misbehavior precludes the court from following that procedure.
Why wouldn't you just have the jury trial? Why wouldn't that be the default? I think that was a question that Judge.
The question absolutely, and I think the U.S. Supreme Court in Illinois versus Allen, in deciding that case, the facts were a little bit different, but in deciding that case, they talk about how there may be less situations where you would have a defense, where the court might assume that the defendant wanted to plead guilty. I can't really speak to that. But
basis for the assumption that he didn't want a jury?
Well, as Judge Petty pointed out, the record appears to support the court's conclusion that there was no jury present. This defendant was represented by counsel throughout this proceeding. When the judge made the statement, and of course I'll back up and say what was happening here is the defendant refused to cooperate, refused to respond to any of the court's questions, and the court says, okay, what we're going to do is I am going to make some statements, and if you don't speak up, I am going to assume that you agree with my statements. And so he goes through the whole...
That goes back to my question. If he then says, I assume you're pleading guilty,
so he is...
Is that constitutionally infirm?
He's...
Yes or no? And then whatever else you want to say.
No, it's not necessarily unconstitutionally infirm.
If he doesn't plead guilty, the trial court could have, under this circumstance, assume he was pleading guilty.
The way you framed it, Your Honor, was in a vacuum. I think Illinois versus Allen And this court's decision in Martin brings up the tension in that's created as a result of a defendant whose behavior causes certain things.
What if the defendant just equivocates? Gee, I don't know. Maybe I could do that. And he's just equivocal and refuses to choose. What choice does the court then make for him?
I think that's an even harder question, Your Honor.
But is that any different?
Well, it's not. It is different because we don't have those facts. And what I keep harping on this, but what this court has said in Martin, and what this court said, and what the U.S. Supreme Court said, is you need to leave the playing field open for the trial court to make certain decisions.
I know there's a state bar legal ethics opinion that says that a defense attorney cannot waive a jury on behalf of his client without express consent. And I know there's a state bar opinion that says that it's misconduct by an attorney to represent to the court that his client has waived a jury when in fact he's not.
Your Honor, I do not think that those state bar opinions are relevant to this case at all. What is relevant here are the cases that you have before you and the cases on which we relied.
Right? How do you get around right, where we say that there must be he's elected a bench trial, there must be a showing of some deliberate action by the accused indicating an election to forego his right to jury trial. It is necessary that his consent be in some manner made manifest. Something more than silence must appear.
You have situations where there is misconduct on the part of the defendant.
Misconduct?
I'm sorry?
Why is this misconduct?
Because he refuses to answer the court's questions. And at that point, the court says, here's what we're going to do. Here's how I'm going to handle this.
In the sense of being disruptive, it's choosing not to answer the question. The court at that point could say, okay, well, I will enter a not guilty plea for you. I'm going to set this for a jury trial. Wouldn't that be the appropriate way? Because you've got a constitutional right to a trial by jury, not a constitutional right to a bench trial.
Yes, that's right. However, it's our position that
Is it all disruptive during the actual trial? After the colloquy, the bench trial occurred, was there any disruption that would have made it difficult to do a jury trial?
No. But, again, what we're talking about is what the court was faced with and whether the court was required to set this matter down for a jury. And I think what was in play here and what was important with regard to the cases that we've cited, and I hate to keep repeating them, but what's important here is what's going on. And in this case, this record shows that this defendant came into court and he first wanted to fire his lawyer, which would have necessitated a delay in the proceeding. The second thing that happened was that his lawyer picked up on the defendant's desire to introduce a videotape. And the court rejected that, asked for a short continuance. What was going on here is this defendant wanted a continuance. And however he got it, it didn't matter to him. So after those two initial motions were denied, he stands up and refuses to respond to the court's...
That's exactly the situation we had in Wright. And in Wright, we said, we recognize that a last-minute request for a jury trial may cause hardships and scheduling difficulties, but we also believe that it's not a problem without a solution. Under the scheme mandated by our Constitution and augmented by statute and rules, circuit courts must assume that a trial will be by jury unless and until the accused knowingly and intelligently waives that right.
In this particular case, we have a methodology that was employed by the court that allowed the defendant to exercise his right to jury trial if he wanted to. All he had to do was speak up.
The court was wrong in not having a jury there in the first place, according to Wright, where the defendant had not waived that jury right.
Well, the outcome in that case, certainly there is language that supports that view. However, I think the cases say that what has to be paramount is that the judge has to be given the latitude to decide to handle the issue as he sees fit. So where we are on this case is whether there was an abuse of discretion, and our position is there was not. There's no showing.
Ms. Darren, when I asked the question earlier, you pointed out the words express and explicit do not appear in Article 1, Section 8. My question is a little different. In our cases interpreting Article 1, Section 8, have we, in a published decision that would be binding on this panel, used the word express or explicit or words of similar import?
In the context of a 1987 case, yes, this court has. However, I think the context, the facts of that case are different. And I think if you juxtapose the more recent cases of Martin and in light of Illinois versus Allen, I think the upshot is that the court has to be given the discretion.
And the Commonwealth concedes there was no express or explicit waiver from the jury.
Well, again, the Commonwealth's position is, and in Boas, the Virginia Supreme Court said it, that there is no requirement for that. So, there is no requirement for that. So, I guess I should back up and say, to the extent that there's a conflict between.
But they don't say it doesn't have to be expressed. They say there's no form. You don't have to fill it out. You don't have to say it verbally. You don't have to put it on the record. You don't have to swear. As long as you get the consent, it's fine. But it doesn't say the consent doesn't have to be expressed in Boas, does it?
It simply says that nothing is said in the Constitution about the manner in which this consent may be evidenced. So,
Boas says that it's necessary that this consent be in some manner made manifest.
And in this case, it was. By the virtue of the court's chosen method of proceeding.
That's not consent. He didn't consent. He just didn't object.
Well,
because the court said, I'm going to assume that if you don't say something, then you want to waive that right.
I understand what the court is saying, and our position is a very narrow one. And under the circumstances of this case, the court, in its discretion, did not abuse its discretion when handling the matter as it did. And given the fact that the defendant had an opportunity to raise this claim, the record shows that he filed a pro se motion while the case pended in the circuit court. He was represented by counsel. Counsel did not pursue the motion. All of these things suggest that this method of behavior was in an attempt to subvert the court's authority, and the court did what it did, and did so without abusing its discretion. We ask that the court affirm. Thank you.
Yes.
I'd like to start. The Commonwealth puts a lot of emphasis on the Martin case. What I would point out to the court is even the defendant in Martin had a jury trial. He was disruptive. He was eventually bound and gagged, obviously inappropriately, but he still had a jury trial. So I think that is worth noting, certainly. As far as whether this was a delay tactic, I would also point out Mr. Richardson in this case was held. So I think to argue that this was a delay tactic is a bit flimsy. And I think it cuts against common sense. I would also point the court to not only does this...
I think our point in terms of the delay tactic is perhaps witnesses disappear that might inure to the defendant's benefit by dragging it out.
Certainly. But I think, again, that it was addressed by Wright and was even more recently addressed by the Robinson case out of Richmond.
He would have been held in one manner or another regardless.
Yes, and he is civilly committed, so that certainly would be an issue. But the delay tactic argument was brought up and roundly put down in both Wright and Robinson. And so I realize that the Commonwealth and I disagree as to what the standard of review in this case is. Certainly my position is it is a constitutional issue. It's a de novo standard of review. But even under the abuse of discretion standard that the Commonwealth suggests, I would put to this panel, denying somebody their constitutional right is always going to be an abuse of discretion. And so it's for that reason that I would ask this court to reverse the finding of the trial court and remand for a new trial for Mr. Richardson.
All right, thank you, counsel. We'll come down and brief.